My name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV podcast network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called Vineyards, Rocks, and Soils, The Wine Lover's Guide to Geology by Alex Maltman. When studying wine, one of the tricks that I've often used to remember various facts or places or things is a mnemonic device. So something that helps you remember a series of terms or places. And long before I ever learned anything about wine, one of the first mnemonic devices I ever learned goes like this. Come over someday, maybe play poker, three jacks can take queens. This episode is sponsored by Psalm TV. This year is bringing amazing new content, including Verticals Season 2, Blind Tasting Sessions Season 3, brand new series, March Movie Mondays, live watches and drink-alongs, and several new Psalm films such as Judgment of Paris, Ghosts of Spring Mountain, and Psalm 4, Cup of Salvation. Sign up now for $5.99 a month or $49.99 for the whole year. So for any of my rock jocks or quartz dorks out there, this may ring a bell for you. This is a mnemonic device that helps you remember geologic periods. Come over someday, maybe play poker, three jacks can take queens. Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Mississippian, yada, yada, yada. And I first learned this when I was a little kid. I've talked about my nerd level, and I'm about to disclose something that's going to take it into the stratosphere. But when I was a kid, I went to summer camp, like many little kids do. And I went to the same camp over and over from when I was quite young to when I was in high school. And it's called Nature Camp. It's an environmental science and conservation camp. And one of the things, wait for it, that kids do, in addition to like hiking and playing, you know, like sports and things like that, is to take classes in the natural sciences willingly on their summer break. And one of the classes that was always offered was geology. And so my little, you know, 11-year-old brain got an intro to geology during the summer. And that was one of the first things I learned. And it has literally stuck with me ever since. So long story, but I love myself a mnemonic device. And that idea of remembering geologic periods or epochs or eras, it's critical to understanding sort of the basis to this book. So I honestly can't tell you how I became aware of this book, but I can tell you that it has blown my mind. It is a book all about, well, vineyards, rocks, and soils. And one of the big things with wine that we talk about is the sense of like minerality or the sense of terroir, that you can taste the sense of place of where the grapes are grown, and therefore you can use that to help identify a wine. And oh my God, I feel like everything I ever learned is just, it's just not the same anymore. So the thing about minerality, and this is something that's been discussed a lot recently, is we know there's something about this idea of terroir, a sense of place in wine. We can taste it. If you grow the same grape and control for, you know, all the things you can control for, viticulture and vinification, but in two separate places, this grapevine is planted, and you make the resulting wine, the wines won't taste the same. And frequently, even more than frequently, often, people ascribe that difference to geology. And it's just not that simple, I guess is the meat of this. So this book, well, it starts on a very elemental basis. And it is an introduction to geology. I should say that Alex Maltman is a professor and a researcher of geology. He's Welsh. And I cannot pronounce the university that he worked at, but this is his career as a geologist and as a teacher. And so he starts on the very kind of basic level of explaining what vineyards are made of on an elemental level of atoms and ions and how those combine to form compounds that make minerals and rocks and soils. Now, the beginning of this book is very foundational. And look, it's a little dry. It's a little hard and crumbly. It's a little dense to get through. I'm sorry, the rock puns, I will not, and I cannot be stopped. They will just come bubbling out like a subterranean spring. So he explains things on a very fundamental level. And one of the crucial things to understand is how these elements, how these nutrients, how these minerals can be made bioavailable and can then be adsorbed or absorbed into vine roots is through a process called cation exchange capacity. And look, I'm not going to delve into the like big time chemistry aspects of this, but it is really important to understand that the minerals that we know exist in the ground largely are not able to be absorbed by vine roots, by plant roots. That's just a fundamental explained concept in geology and botany. But there is so much more to it than that. So there's instruction on how, you know, how minerals work and the shape of crystals and how to identify them, and some minerals that just, you know, are readily available and naturally exist. He explains that minerals make up rocks and they make up the soil. And then there's a chapter devoted to each of the three types of rock. Any geologists out there would likely sarcastically quip that the three types of rock are hard, punk, and classic, but in fact, they are igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. And those are thoroughly explained as to how they are formed. And then he kind of gives an overview of the lay of the land. Now, this book is 227 pages, not including the index. And that whole introductory, you know, Geo 101, rocks for jocks, that takes up like the first 150 pages. So the ninth chapter, starting around page 159, really delves into weathering soil and minerals. And then we really start getting into the influence of how all of this stuff, all this foundational information that is presented in this book, can actually affect wines. Now, throughout the entire book, one thing that really, really was amazing to me is just how knowledgeable the author is about wine growing regions throughout the world, because it never fails that throughout this entire book, when he's explaining a particular mineral and its prevalence, or the origin of this, that, or the other, or you know, tectonics or things like that, it's always tied into a wine growing region around the world. And so that keeps it fascinating. And look, I definitely napped my way through college chemistry, and I definitely use this book as a precursor to naps at times. Some of this stuff is just, it's not necessarily engrossing, but it's really important to understand. And one of the things that kind of kept me coming back for more was the fact that it never strayed away from this goal or this idea that all of this information ties into the overarching theme of the book, which is about vineyard geology. To start at the very beginning, the author introduces minerals, rocks, and soils, and how they're the constituent elements of the vineyard ground. And so minerals are really relevant to vineyards, and there are thousands of different types of minerals. But what's remarkable about them is that in nature, the same few of them are found again and again and again, collected roughly together in similar proportions, and they've bonded together to form rocks. So a rock is defined in this book as a coherent, rigid, solid aggregate of minerals. Minerals combine to make rocks. So rocks are not the same as minerals. And that's an important thing, because we talk about, you know, if we think about how we talk about wines, those two words get used interchangeably. And that's also something that the author continually picks apart, is that a lot of the words we use to describe wines with regard to earthiness or minerality, we're kind of misappropriating the terminology. And so in a very gentle way, he corrects, explains, and then moves on to the next topic at hand. Rocks are hard to classify. The three major types are, you know, the sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic. They're classified on how they are made. But a large part of geology is classifying rocks based on when they were formed. And so there's a bunch of different ways to classify rocks. And there is a geologist joke that the geologists love rocks so much, they try to date them. And by date them, that's just referring to a specific age. And so oftentimes we see terms for rocks used to describe wine. And all that term actually references is the age of the rock. It doesn't actually, you know, tell you a little bit more, nor does it draw a connection or a conclusion as to why that rock indicates anything about the flavor of the wine. Throughout this entire book, in between all of the information about geology, there's so much kind of little tidbits that are tucked in that relate to geology that just I never knew. And so I could feel myself actively learning more. And I said that, I think, about the first book I reviewed for this podcast, Flawless by Jamie Good, who's referenced in this book, by the way. All these books seem to inadvertently kind of combine or come together with some sort of relative aspect. But in that book and in this book, I could feel myself like learning new things, like actively becoming maybe a little bit more knowledgeable. And I love that. It's an addictive feeling. And so just little tidbits in the section about the different types of minerals that are widely available. There's a subchapter called sulfate minerals. Super exciting stuff. And the author just indicates little things like, sulfate minerals include things like gypsum, which is chemically calcium sulfate. And we know that as, you know, plaster. and it's the plaster that was historically used for encasing broken bones. And deposits of gypsum occur beneath Paris, particularly around Montmartre. And it was intensively mined in the Middle Ages, and it was used to coat the walls of houses, and it acted as a fireproofing agent, which explains, and this is what I learned, why Paris suffered far less fire damage than London, because the houses were coated with this plaster. So therefore, gypsum has become to be known as plaster of Paris. What? I'd heard of plaster of Paris before, but it's just a little tidbit. It's a little paragraph tucked into that has nothing to do with wine. And I'm like, oh no, seriously? Or, you know, plaster of Paris is famous, but there's a little tidbit about London too. How in the 17th century, the waters in the spa town of Epsom, a few kilometers to the west of the city, became celebrated for their, wait for it, laxative purposes. At the height of the vogue, people were apparently drinking up to 16 pints of a day of these fashionable waters, which apparently gave them very, quote, funny results. The secret ingredient of the waters was magnesium sulfate, which still bears the time-honored name Epsom salts. I'm going to quote from the author here. The compound is still used as a purgative. Apparently, the likes of Gwyneth Paltrow and Victoria Beckham swear by it. But it's also used in viticulture. So little tidbits here and there that are geological in origin, but pop culture in reference make their way throughout this book. And it just, in what could be a very, very dense subject, it keeps it really fresh and really interesting. So like I said, the middle section of this book is, well, actually the first two thirds of this book are really, you know, it's the bedrock of this information, and it's a little bit harder to digest. But about halfway through, it starts to, I guess, pick up a little bit in the pace. But throughout this entire book, it sort of, I don't know, it builds and builds and builds on the knowledge that is presented. But in addition to kind of building up your just basic geologic knowledge, tying it into classic vineyard areas, there's a lot of debunking. And what I mean by that is, in a very gentle manner, things that we just took for granted, all our wine speak lives. Did you catch what I said there? Sorry. I just like to make it nice. Just ignore my schist. Okay. There are things throughout the entire wine world that, as long as I've been involved in the wine trade and in wine tasting and in scholarly pursuit of wine knowledge, I have just learned. And thought and probably parroted back. And a lot of that stuff scientifically is perhaps incorrect. So in no particular order, the author discusses how certain compounds or minerals such as talc or graphite or chalk can be used in tasting descriptors and how none of that is actually correct. And it makes me think of one of probably the most referenced scenes in the Somme movie. And there's a whole scene where all of the characters are talking about the different flavors and things they perceive in the wine. And there's one quick spot where one of the characters talks about licking rocks. And I think this is something that, you know, this is not unique to this individual. Like lots of people do. I'm sitting in my office and I have a rock collection full of, you know, rocks that I've absconded from famous vineyards around the world. Like if you're into wine, this is not unusual. I have not licked these rocks. I have maybe rubbed them in my hands and smelled them. And we'll get to why that creates aromas in just a little bit. But it's so interesting because, and I think about people, you know, tasting wine in front of me or me doing, you know, a blind tasting. And we talk about the minerality of a wine and we talk about, you know, certain characteristics that we are getting like hints of graphite or chalkiness, whether we're talking about a wine from Bordeaux or a wine from, you know, Chablis. And well, geologically and scientifically, it's just not possible to taste those things. So for instance, talc appears in tasting notes and it's a silicate mineral. And like all silicate minerals, talc is flavorless. Comprehensive data sheets mention neither taste nor smell. But the aspect of talc that's noteworthy is its softness. The silky feel of powdered talc is well known. And therefore, tasting notes, according to the author, presumably relate the mouthfeel of wine to its exceptional softness. Now, if you think about maybe one of the most common and commercially available sources of talc, you think of like baby powder, right? Well, there's aroma added to that. That's just not the natural smell of talc. And so I'm not suggesting you like shake a, you know, a container of baby powder into your mouth, but I'm willing to trust the geology professor when he tells me that talc has no taste. Or say graphite, Wines from, you know, from certain areas are described as tasting of graphite, and it's a common tasting note mostly for red wines. However, according to this author, it has to be a metaphor, as the mineral graphite has no flavor. In a series of articles in Decanter, which is a wine magazine, Decanter attempted to decode tasting terms and tackled two often used to describe Bordeaux, graphite and cigar box, and explained that the term graphite signifies notes of pencil lead or lead-like minerality. There should be a red light flashing every time we hear minerality with wine now. The mention of lead seems unhelpful, seeing as how pencils actually never involve the element lead. Is your mind being blown? Pencil lead is made of graphite mixed with kaolinite or bentonite clay. And just like metallic lead, it is both tasteless and odorless. The explanation concluded by saying if you're unsure what graphite smells like, try sharpening a pencil. But the pronounced odor of old-fashioned pencils is due to the aromatic compounds which are found in the types of wood that are used for making the pencils, sesquiterpenes, and incidentally, cigar boxes. These compounds are well known in wines, and so it would seem that the source of the graphite pencil perception comes from the wood and not the mineral itself. Well, damn. Chalk is a term that is frequently used to describe wines, and a chalky kind of characteristic that we get from certain wines. And while chalk makes an excellent substrate for viticulture and all of these conditions are described, it's basically a subset of limestone. It is not something that we, you know, can actually taste. This limestone, this chalky style of limestone, it doesn't have a taste and it doesn't have a smell. In addition to debunking tasting notes and what we typically have used to describe, you know, what we think is a mineral sense in wine, this book also debunks other things in a very subtle, like without even explicitly stating what it's talking about, but in a very kind of gentle way. The first, oh my God, out loud experience I had with this book was nearly at the very end. It's in this chapter called Soil, Water, Sunshine, and the Concept of Terroir. And it's just in a little paragraph tucked in to the very end. And it's just talking about misconceptions. And one of the misconceptions is that the water in the ground, or for that matter, parenthetically stated, the water in a grapevine, is not affected by the moon's gravity. That water is too constrained to respond quickly enough to the daily changes in the lunar gravitational field, and it lacks sufficient mass anyway. The idea often proclaimed is that because our oceans show tides and they are affected by the moon's gravity, so must everything else, including grapevines. This was shown to be wrong over 3 centuries ago. An object has to have substantial mass and freedom in order to have a significant response to the moon's gravity, and only 4 things in the Earth system have that mass and freedom. The oceans, of course, the biggest lakes, the atmosphere, and the solid Earth itself. The Earth has tides, potentially enormous because of its mass, but rocks are resilient on the timescale of hours. Nothing else on the planet has sufficient mass to interact gravitationally with the moon. Innocuous little paragraph, just tucked in here in this concept of terroir, right? Oh, you want to know why my face exploded? Well, this is a concept that, and I'm not personally debunking the concept of biodynamics, but there is a whole style of viticulture dedicated to this very holistic idea of how a vine interacts with the world around it. And there's many principles in biodynamics, and this is something that was espoused in the beginning of the 20th century by an Austrian named Rudolf Steiner. It's a pretty interesting reading. But among the many different applications of biodynamic viticulture, one of them is that the vines are affected by the moon, and that if the moon can affect the tides, then certainly it could affect the rising sap in the vines. And so when the moon is full, presumably when it would have a larger or stronger gravitational pull, an in-tune viticulturist would not prune their vines because it would cause greater harm because the sap would be high in the vines. And that seemed logical to me, and I believed it. And I thought, okay, that makes complete sense. And how hard is it just to not prune your vines when the moon is full? You know, that doesn't seem like a big deal to me. But then I read this and I went, oh my God, if that's not true, if there isn't sufficient mass in the water in the ground or in vines to be affected by the gravitational pull of the moon, then that's what, coincidence? Merely observational, like, you know, just observational data rather than actually meted scientific data. I don't even, y'all, I am struggling for words, but it's something that I've just thought was just, it made sense to me. And then I read what is basically a scientific text and it's telling me that that's all wrong. Everything I've known is wrong. Other cool information kind of makes its way into here. When we talk about pH and the relative acidity of soils, that's an important characteristic. And the relative pH of a soil can have impacts on the relative pH of the resultant wine. But just tucked away in here, cool tidbits like the pH scale was originally devised at a brewery in Denmark to understand how hydrogen ions were affecting enzymes in beer. Curiously, the yeast Brettanomyces, which is a spoilage yeast for wine, and I've talked about that before in Jamie Good's book, but is also widely incorporated in beer brewing, was actually, this Brettanomyces was first isolated at the same brewery in Denmark during experiments on the spoilage of British ale, hence the microbe's Latinized name for British fungus, Brettanomyces. What? I had no idea. And that's just a thing. Like, Brett's just around. We talk about it. It's that thing that gives wines the smell of, you know, the north end of a southbound horse. It's that fecal barnyard manure-y smell. And it's a spoilage yeast. And it's something that's very frequently found in beers. And I never gave one passing thought to the etymology of the name. But there you go. So just like over and over, this book just blew my mind. Anyway, concept after concept that are talked about in wine writings are just gently analyzed, contemplated, and dismissed. One thing that we talk about or that we read about a lot in wine writing is the effects of soil on the ripening of grapes, how sunlight can, or geology can benefit vines by reflecting sunlight onto the grapes to enhance grape ripening, and can also absorb the sun's warmth to re-radiate it at night. And the author gently says, putting aside for the moment the contradiction between simultaneously reflecting sunshine and absorbing it, we might question how distinctive a factor this is, judging by the writings of most kind of rocks. They can all do it. So we talk about this like in Germany, right? Where the dark blue or gray slate in this northerly cold climate can absorb the sunlight and reflect it back. But the author will then continuously quote from books, from websites, from chances, about all these different types of vineyards based on all different types of, you know, of bedrock and different soil types, whether it's limestone based in Sancerre or, you know, granite or gravel. And one by one, they are all described as sharing these properties. So it's actually maybe not unique to any particular type of rock, but universally available to almost all types of rocks. Again, I will rethink how I talk about wine from here on out. Now, I think one of the most impactful parts of this book is right at the end. And that, I mean, it makes for a great ending, but you kind of have to work to get there. So this book, like I said, is not very long, but when we get to sort of chapter 11, and then finally the epilogue is where things start to really heat up. The epilogue has a subtitle and it says, is vineyard geology important for wine taste? And it's like, finally, this is what we've been trying to get to the whole time, right? This entire book for 100 and, you know, for 200 pages, I've been like trying to pull all these things together because I feel like I was getting a really good education and re-education in all things geologic and mineral. But then I was like, all right, this book is about, you know, not just where these rocks are in terms of famous vineyard areas, but to what extent does geology affect the taste in your wine glass? The perception that of a mineral taste in wine, it can't have a literal meaning. And this author thoroughly over the course of the 11 previous chapters explains one after the other how these minerals that we, you know, can see and touch, these rocks, these aggregate minerals, they don't actually have a smell and a taste. So there's basically a divergence between popular beliefs and scientific understanding of geology. It's the wine flavor connection. Part of this explanation, he thinks, and this is where this book isn't just a Debbie Downer. It's not just blowing up common notions of everything you've held to be true in terms of your tasting notes and wine descriptors, but there's a disconnect. There's a divergence. And he thinks that part of the explanation may be that many of the populist assertions maybe are based on custom and an anecdote. And if you, for example, look at at different vineyards throughout the world. And oftentimes what we see, you know, we might see the terraces that are cut into the Northern Rhone or the dark black soil, you know, the dark black slate, the blue or the gray Devonian slate in the Mosel, or the Galais rule of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. We associate these different types of wine with these very distinctive and types of soil and geology. And so there is a little bit of its marketing, a little bit of its anecdotal, but there's not a direct scientific explanation for the rocks causing any particular flavor in the wine. What the author suggests is, while it might not be cause and effect, there are lots of characteristics of things in the soil that probably affect greater differentiation of tastes in different wines. And the largest sort of responsibility or source of different flavors in finished wines is the fermentation process, actually, as a result. One of the biggest takeaways from this book is that the types of soil that are referenced in wine literature, whether it's tasting notes or books or things like that, it oftentimes refers to the bedrock. And one thing this book does a really good job of explaining is that the bedrock is largely impermeable, and vine roots may reach the bedrock. They are not searching for minerals. They are searching for water. And while tips of the vine roots might be exploring fissures or cracks in the bedrock, a lot of them actually exist, these roots exist closer to the soil. And it's the soil water, the water that's trapped into the soil, which is weathered or decomposed rock and humus, or, you know, decomposed organic matter. It's the soil and the microbial action in the soil and the soil water that actually have a little bit more influence on what uptake happens with the vine. But the bedrock is largely inert, and those minerals are not accessed or able to be absorbed by the vine roots. And oftentimes when we read about the wine and its geologic kind of tie-in, what's being referenced is the bedrock. And so that's just kind of fundamentally incorrect. We might read about, you know, the limestone of a vineyard in Alsace giving big strapping wines, or that Cote Rôti has a schist-inspired clarity, or wine from a particular AVA is muscular and masculine because it came from granite soil. And there's no explanation and there's no caveats. The direct role of geology just seems to be kind of associative in a lot of these wine writings. And the point is that there's so much more, and there's so much more that's unstudied. In fact, there's a very strong argument. It's not made throughout this book, but there's a very strong argument that it's not so much the geology and the minerals, but a lot more of the soil water, the humus, and the individual microbiome, bacteria that exist on the grape skins, and of course, everything that results from fermentation. So in the last couple pages of this book, you know, as I'm going through these books, I oftentimes underline passages that I want to reference or think back to, and I basically underline this entire, you know, segment. It's entitled, "But We Can't Taste Rocks in Wine." And it's essentially this idea, you know, there are tasting notes that are quoted. You can really taste the volcanic minerals in the wine, or you can taste the Devonian slate right there in the glass. And the idea that the author says that a vineyard's geology can literally be tasted in your wine is enthusiastically promoted, prolonging a belief dating back to times before the discovery of photosynthesis, when wine was thought to be made from soil. And there's also this idea of kind of a yearning for a closer connection with the land. And it's, as the author says, scientifically untenable. Vine roots are incapable of absorbing the solid complex compounds that make up the rocks and soil of a vineyard, and geologic materials are generally tasteless and odorless anyway. I love this quote right here. As the geologist Kevin Pogue put it at the 2017 Oregon Wine Symposium, "Tasting the limestone may sound romantic, but it is no different than saying you can taste the 30-degree slope or the 220-degree aspect. Limestone doesn't have a flavor, and neither does the 220-degree aspect." Take that, mull it over, think about it, and before you taste wine again or describe it or read a description of a wine or a wine book, just keep that in the back of your head. Because it's scientific truth. And so it's important to really understand most of what we taste of wine is produced during vinification. And that's what sets the wines apart, not what the roots absorb. And that's really important because when we think about how vines uptake all these nutrients, that's at the very beginning of the process of what will ultimately become the finished product of the wine, right? That's just the plant, which can be very selective on what it uptakes. It doesn't just absorb willy-nilly, and all plants absorb things, not just grapevines. They don't have the ability to differentially absorb. But that's just at the very beginning of the uptake of bioavailable nutrients and water in the vine. And then we have to actually have growth and, you know, bud break and flowering and fruiting and a growing season, harvesting and veraison, and then fermentation. And so there are so many other things. If we really wanted to study, and the author points this out in a very clear example, if we really wanted to study the ability to uptake nutrients and the flavors that it could result in, instead of studying grapevines, we should study carrots, because carrots are root vegetables. They grow in the dirt and they're right there absorbing whatever soil water and bioavailable nutrients are there. And if it affects the flavor of the carrot, then we should be able to taste it. But a carrot is the finished product and you can eat it, whereas we're not eating the grapevine. We're eating the fermented product of the fruit of the grapevine. And I thought that that was a really important kind of comparison, is that it's just too simplistic to look at things this way. It's very romantic. It's incredibly poetic, but it's far too simplistic. And there's a vast, you know, gap in explanation and scientific correlation. Now, that said, we know that, for example, you know, I might not lick the rocks that I have in my collection in my office, but if I were to hold them in my hand, my soil from Grand Cru Chablis, or my rocks from Grand Cru Chablis, or from a Crayer and Champagne, if I were to rub them on my hands and then smell my hands, that would have a unique smell. And look, the author doesn't dismiss that. He says that, you know, so much of what we taste actually does depend on our smell, and geologic minerals are insoluble, with the exception of like halides, like things like salts, but salts aren't things that, you know, viticulturists are looking for in their vineyards. But an odor, an aroma, or a smell requires that a substance be a vapor in order for us to sense it. I'm not going to tip my hat as to what I'm going to review next, but there might be an analysis of how we smell things coming down the pipeline. So for a solid or liquid to be aromatic, it must easily vaporize. And rocks and minerals don't do this. However, if you think about like rubbing a rock in your hands or smelling that, the odor doesn't come from the rock itself, but a reaction between the skin chemicals and whatever it is that you're touching that can give those easily sensed aromatic compounds. The same thing is true with metal. Metals generally lack odor, but we talk about things having a metallic smell. Well, it's the interaction between what's happening in our hands and what's happening in the metal. The taste of wine reminding us of stones, you know, that's something I've said that a whole lot. And I know I've kind of harped on this, but there's a really kind of interesting point that the author makes in the conclusion of his epilogue, which is the most, you know, conclusion dense part of the book that I could imagine. It's this idea, of course, you know, when we're describing certain perceptions in wine, we reference geological things, but of course they're metaphors, they're mental associations, and they may be recollections of some past encounter involving rocks, but not actually things present in the wines and vines. And we might actually conjure up in our minds, you know, what a stone should taste like. And there's a really good example given here about how a lot of commentators might mention a flinty taste in wine. Say, for example, in the wines of Chablis or Sancerre, you know, it's important to know, like in the case of Sancerre, if, you know, silex is one of the three major soil types in Sancerre, which is just the French word for flint. But Chablis soils have no flint. Conversely, as the author points out, there are wines from the Margaux district of the Médoc or the Martillac region of the Graves that do have flint, but those wines are very seldom said to have that particular flavor. Flint itself, like other forms of silica, because it's actually a form of silica, is wholly without taste or smell, which is exactly why glass is made of silica. So the author says it's a very curious thing to describe a wine tasting like flint, which is a type of silica, when it is bottled in glass, which is primarily made of silica, and especially if it's being tasted out of a wine glass, which is also made of silica. So where does that flavor come from, right? Because geologically, the dots don't connect. Now, there are a few aromas that are commonly or more recently talked about that are ascribed to being minerally in aspect or rocky in aspect, but they actually are much more organic in nature. And I was glad to see these included because these are things that I can definitely perceive in wines. One is this idea of something called petrichor, which is this idea of the smell of rocks or stones on a hot summer day after a rainstorm, or like the smell of rocks at a river's edge. And we associate that term, petrichor, with the smell of wet rocks. And wet rocks is a term that is used oftentimes, very often, in wine descriptors, whether in commercial trade or in tasting notes. And it's not actually the rocks. What that is the vaporization of certain organic oils. And that term is given the term petrichor. Or the earthy smell in wine is due to airborne organic compounds that are common on vines and in wineries. And that's called geosmin. And I talked about a couple of these things in the very first podcast review, Flawless by Jamie Good. And it's just really interesting to see kind of the connection through to this book as well. It ends on a really, poetic note. I mean, this book is wholly scientific and 100% a reference text. But, the author doesn't dismiss the idea of terroir. He just wants people to understand more clearly what they're saying and where the connections are. And he talks about, the visual distinction between wine growing places throughout the world and the taste of a wine in the glass. And he believes that wine can be perfectly enjoyable in its own right. It's more than just a liquid in a glass when you think about where it comes from and how it was made. And geologic perspectives will enrich the tasting experience and add to his appreciation. It's just there's so much more to it than I think we know, can explain, or can measure. So what works in this book? Well, the tone throughout this entire book is wonderful. This author is an undergraduate teacher. He's got years, decades of experience as a college professor and researcher in geology. And so he's clearly taught people who know nothing. And so he's able to explain really convoluted topics or things that maybe wouldn't be as interesting on the surface in a very clever way. He always ties it back to the idea of how it relates to vineyards and grape growing and winemaking. It's not just a book about geology. It's very consistent all the way throughout. And he's really funny. He ties in, little pop culture references. He makes little, kind of inserts his own thoughts and feelings. I mean, there's a little, or curious, or that's interesting. And you can kind of read between the lines and see where he's going with, with his perspective on things. It's really well written. And it's, like I said, I feel like this book not only made me more knowledgeable, it makes me question so much of what I think I've already known. Now, for what doesn't work, like I said, 2/3 of this book it's pretty tough stuff to get through if you don't have a lot of caffeine or an intense desire to learn about geology. I really wanted to learn from this book and I did, but I'm not going to lie, it was not a fast read until the very end. And then I was tearing through it, underlining everything. But it's not a super fast read. And the other thing that was a little bit disappointing to me is throughout this book, there are pictures that illustrate what's being explained. It could be pictures of rocks, it could be charts, it could be maps and things like that. But by and large, throughout the entire book, the pictures are all black and white. But there is an 8-page section in the middle of the book with glossy paper and color versions of all of those pictures. And it really, really helps. But I wish that they had been interspersed throughout the book, because then you have to flip to the middle and reference that plate. And it just, there's a little bit of a disconnect. And I feel, me being a visual learner, that seeing that color image of the rock and being able to more clearly differentiate the grains and the colors and things like that, I feel like it would have illustrated the point more clearly rather than just having a section in the middle. So I wasn't crazy for that, but it's really hard to find fault with this book. It's really quite fascinating. So for my rating, 100%, this is a buy. This book, forgive me, rocked my world. It is so interesting. And I feel like I am going to look at tasting notes and wine writings and every other book that talks about terroir differently. And I recognize that, one person's words are not gospel. You have to, in a scientific mind, you have to do your research and you have to accumulate data. But this gentleman's an expert and he very clearly and very logically lays out his argument. And it is compelling. Full disclosure, if you are not in academic pursuit of wine or a geology buff, this might not be your jam. That said, it's a small book. It's like 5x8. I have the hardcover. It's not a big book, but I feel like this is a reference text that you could go back and look up and reference. And there's so much to learn from it that it might not be for everybody, but for those who buy it and read it, I'm cautiously going to assert that you will find this indispensable. How do you take that for a reading? So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what you heard, and don't forget to subscribe, download, and give us a rating. See you next time. This episode was sponsored by Somm TV. Somm TV can be yours for $5.99 a month and $49.99 for the whole year. And what do you get for that? An amazing array of wine-related content. And there is some really special content that's new this year, including new seasons of verticals and blind tasting sessions, brand new series, live watches and drink-alongs, and some new Somm films.